Welcome to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater, and good morning, Claudio.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone out there tuning us in.
Yes.
How are you? How's the home building going?
Oh, right now, I can't even think of it because I've got kids in from Maine and New Hampshire.
Perish the thought. It's Turkey Day.
Holidays are coming on, and people are showing up at all odd hours, and I'm cooking stuff and...
You're being a mum.
I'm being a mum.
Mum's the word.
Yes.
We have the wonderful pleasure of having somebody from WCOM on our show today. His name is Ken Fuller, and we're going to go into his life in just a moment, but I do want to introduce a few things about him. He's a concert musician going all the way back to the days of Otis Redding, a photographer, TV producer, and radio host. His television show is KTV TV Show, and his show on WCOM from 11 to 1 on Fridays is rock, soul, and pop, 60s and 70s. And he's here in the studio with us today. Give us a good morning there.
Good morning. Hey. Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Great to have you on. And I want to do my usual thing of opening up with a little bit of a monologue just to keep us aware of things out there. But I also do want to do the usual thing, and that is acknowledge the historic Carolina Theatre of Durham, that is the primary sponsor of Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theatre here on WCOM 103.5 FM. Good, I got it all in.
This is, you'd be surprised, we are heard around the globe. We can check our Facebook page, and there's at least 11 or 12 different countries that will click on our Facebook page.
That's incredible, because yes. I know I've received emails from India and from Germany saying they like the show, and I respond like, when do you listen? They say, podcast, silly.
Yes. So,
it's wonderful. So whoever's tuning us in, and whenever you get this, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to know there are people out there that believe so much in freedom of speech that they are willing to pursue the non-corporate speak.
And that's one of the things that's great, just to pass the word, that WCOM, you go to our website, www.wcomfm.org, you click on podcasts, and you can pick up a whole bunch of WCOM shows anytime you want to listen.
And you can download them for free.
And go all around the globe and never have to leave, you know, the Paris of the Piedmont right here in Carborough.
With our own little pirate radio station.
Yes, the best little 100-watt wonder that's going. Yep.
I tell you, I still wish, one of my biggest regrets when I lived in the Virgin Islands is that I didn't actually record some real pirate radio stations that came off the coast, came off the water late at night. You pick it up on shortwave, and in some cases you could even pick it up on local radio. Basically, people speaking out against political corruption and things that were actually going on. And you know these people were being hunted down to be killed by governments that didn't appreciate what they were saying, and yet they were doing it. So power to the people and power to freedom of speech. And here's my opening statement in that regard. This is something I'd mentioned. I went through this last week, but I think it's worth mentioning again. I'm calling it The Fix. There was recently an article in the St. Petersburg, Florida Times in the business section where they asked readers, how would you fix the economy? And I think this guy really nailed it. Dear Mr. President, I think at this point we should probably call everybody in that office resident instead of president. I haven't seen anybody act presidential in God knows how long. Anyway, dear Mr. President, please find below my suggestion for fixing the American economy. Instead of giving billions of dollars to companies that will squander the money on lavish parties and unearned bonuses, use the following plan. You can call it the Patriotic Retirement Plan. There are about 40 million people over 50 in the workforce. Pay them $1 million apiece, severance, for early retirement with the following stipulations. One, they must retire. 40 million job openings you'll get as a result. Unemployment fixed. Two, they must buy a new American car, 40 million cars ordered, auto industry fixed. Three, they must either buy a house or pay off their mortgage, housing crisis fixed. It can't get any easier than that. P.S., if more money is needed, have all the members of Congress pay their taxes. Wouldn't that be an actual delight? Mr. President, while you're at it, make Congress retire on Social Security and Medicare. And I'll bet you both programs will be fixed pronto. Let's get those fat butts off their chairs and doing something that's actually right for the American people.
Not bad.
I just have that $1 million waiting for it in the mail.
I'd love to. I could use it, and I promise I'll spend it. Send it.
I promise I'll retire. Mm-hmm.
Whatever political mafia is going on out there. But for some reason, it never falls to the guy that would actually move the money. It always falls to the fat cats that have more than they could ever spend. And they still want more. is that a sickness we can cure? How do you remedy that?
I could go into long philosophical discussion about whether you have a philosophy of abundance or a philosophy of scarcity. If you think the world operates on scarcity, then you've got competition, and I'm going to make sure I get mine.
Don't start the revolution without me.
So anyway, I believe in a world of abundance.
And we actually have it. It's just that it's getting cornered off by those that want to own it.
Just drop out, go to,
Revolution, where are you? Oh, Lord. So now, after all that, I've really gotten you in trouble, Ken. Going to have Ken Fuller on, and I'm going to explore his life, but I'm pretty much going to let him take the lead in that regard. We met here very recently when I was putting my Halloween show together. I came in, and there was a scary ghost sitting in the recording room, and it was Ken. And I just knew after meeting him with his amazing background that I had to have him on the radio show. So every once in a while, you find a big fish right at home here on WCOM. So, Ken, let's spill over to you. You've got a television show. You've got a radio show here on WCOM. And I'm pleased to know you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. And it was a pleasure meeting you as well.
Thank you.
My background starts pretty much in music. I was a concert musician. Right out of high school, grew up in Philadelphia, had the chance to mingle and also, play and perform with some of the great talent.
I would definitely say so. Right on back to Otis Redding, if you don't mind me dropping that name.
Right. Well, I happened to go to an audition when I was 15 years old for Otis Redding to go to England.
Hmm.
Otis Redding, originally, his band was called the Barquets, but the Barquets were an entity of their own, so they were on tour. So mm-hmm. Otis needed a rhythm section to go to England and play. This is 1967.
Goodness.
I was chosen. I wasn't old enough, but I lied. Okay. And we went to England for 17 days. We were over there, and every concert was sold out.
All right.
And that's when I knew that's all I want to do in life is play music. I do it for free.
And how old were you actually at the time? 15, you said?
15, yeah.
Well, you realize that in European, actually in a lot of international countries, that is the age that they pick you for an apprenticeship in whatever they think you might be focused on as your profession for life. So you hit it at the right time.
At the right time.
That's when I learned how to be a chef, 15 to 18.
Exactly.
Ken, what instruments do you play?
I just play guitar. I play lead guitar, bass guitar, rhythm guitar.
Great.
What was so amazing was that in 67, you have to understand that the English invasion had just kind of hit.
Mm-hmm.
The Beatles, 64. Beatles, every night after a concert, either the Beatles came backstage, the Rolling Stones, Elton John. He wasn't even Elton John then. He was just Reginald at that time.
Oh, really?
And we got to meet everybody. I was very amazed that soul music had traveled that far. But when I got over there, I found out that it was bigger in Europe than it was in the States. They knew more about soul music than they did in the States. So that's where it started. From there, I went on to Motown.
It was actually the same thing, pardon the interruption, but it was actually the same thing with jazz.
Oh, absolutely. And still is.
And still is. Yeah.
And still is. From there, I was fascinated with Smokey Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
As a songwriter, singer. So I went to Motown and knocked on his door and said, hey, I want to play for you. He says, okay. He says, you
guy's
still
got guts, doesn't he?
Well, that's the way you had to do it. You
I know, agree, I agree.
Guys would sit around and say, wow, wouldn't it be great if we could play for this one and play for that one? Well, I just did it. I mean, all he could say was no.
Bravo.
So he said, well, are you still in school? I said, yeah. He says, well, come back after you finish school. I'm like, oh. Okay. So I came back.
What, the next day?
Not quite.
I'm done with my school.
Yeah. So I came back. And being from Philadelphia, even though there was a tremendous pool of musicians and singers, it was sort of everybody was in a clique. And I was a little young to be in the clique.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Motown. I went to Detroit. And they started me off on a rotation where I'd play for the Temptations, and then the Four Tops, and then the Supremes, Gladys Knight.
Did you even know what you were doing at that? Did you even realize the fame you were dealing with in that regard?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I knew, well, I started playing guitar at around 10. Mm-hmm. So by the time I was 14, I knew who these people were.
I imagine so, yeah.
And how big they were because of their records.
Right.
And that sort of thing. I stayed with Motown for 7 years. And then I became more like a freelance concert musician. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do a lot of studio recording. I did more stuff on the road. And that took me to, I played with Frankie Valli, Cher, Ray Charles, the Pointer Sisters.
That's incredible. He's sitting right here.
He's right here. The guy found him in the studio.
And there's so many of us that did that at that time. Because, I mean, somebody had to be on the
Absolutely,
road.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, we went. Everywhere. The only place I didn't play music was Africa and China, were the only two countries that I didn't play music in.
And they weren't necessarily that open back in the day for international, the international art scene. Especially China, I know, was a little closed off.
Right. Well, Africa did a, Ike and Tina Turner did a movie called Soul to Soul. And I want to say this is around 68, 69. Mm-hmm. A lot of American R&B groups went over there, and they filmed that. But that was like the beginning. So in traveling and playing music, the people that I met played on Johnny Carson, Saturday Night Live, played all the big houses like Madison Square Garden and that sort of thing. And that's all I ever wanted to do, was meet these people and play for them. You know,
and that start off with the best in the best venues. Great start.
Well, coming from Philly, you were, the competition was fierce.
No doubt.
So if you were good, and if you'd show up, and if you were drug-free, you could always work.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So I stayed in rotation sometimes 300 days out of the year.
You should have asked him to bring his guitar today.
Well, they always want
me to
play
bring
now.
Music and stuff. And
yeah.
He just...
But I don't do that anymore, in a sense of speaking. The latest thing I've done on guitar is I wrote a song, an anti-smoking song, for the American Cancer Society. Well, I sold it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like the latest thing. I only play my stuff now. I've dedicated, I don't know what, about 20 years to other artists, and I really don't ever want to do that.
<That's>
Well,
great.
Heck, you could have done your stuff here today.
Absolutely.
You know,
so I just don't think he was ready for it this time, but we'll pick on him again.
You're going to have to have him back here.
Yeah.
So music, and I was telling Claudio earlier today how in 1971, I wrote a song, and these three girls sang this song. They were one 11-year-old and two 10-year-olds.
Oh, this is a great story.
And we cut a record. Well, we tried to get a record deal, so we went to Motown Records, and Motown wanted the group, but they didn't want their manager. Well, the manager, you know, she wouldn't let the group go. So the record just stayed at Motown, and they put it in the vault. Well, here it is, 2010. I hadn't seen these girls since 1971. Mm. I went to Philadelphia for a 40th class reunion back here in October. And I was determined to find these girls because I hadn't seen or heard from them. Well, I found them. And the first thing they said was,
And you
Kate.
Actually physically went to the neighborhood. This is yeah. You didn't just, you know, try to find them on Facebook or anything. He physically right. went.
I went to the old neighborhood where they lived. And one of them still lived in the same house.
Wow.
Anyway, she said to me, we've been looking for you because your song is on YouTube. I'm like, really? I didn't put it on there. They said, yeah. It's got like 12,000 hits. So I'm like, well, who would have put it on YouTube? So,
he didn't say it was an invasion of my privacy, you notice.
Well, I'll get to that. We tracked it down, and I found the guy that put it up on YouTube. And I contacted him, and I said, you know, where I'm from, when you steal people's music, that's a butt whooping.
Yes, I would say so.
He says, well, I found your song in the vaults of Motown under unreleased material.
And this was now accessible?
Yeah.
Mm, okay.
He says, your copyright expired.
Ooh.
Well, I never thought about renewing the copyright because I wasn't making any money. He says, but Ken, it's a great song. He says, that's why I put it up on YouTube. It's got like 12,000 hits. He says, maybe you might want to think about, you know, doing it again. So we are talking about doing that.
All right.
So that was really interesting to find that my song was on YouTube, you know, and I didn't even know anything about
that
it.
That is awesome.
How do we find it?
Yeah.
It's under the group called The Ultimates.
The Ultimates.
Yeah, The Ultimates. And the name of the song is Why I Love You.
Okay.
Yeah. I wrote the song when I was 13.
My goodness.
And I was 18 when we actually got it recorded. So we're thinking
pretty
about
perceptive
going back.
For a 13-year-old.
Well, yeah, because remember, I started young. I started at a music hit me at about 8 years old.
It was a different day back then, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You grew up a lot quicker.
Yeah, the first time I saw a live band, I knew. And a relative took me to what was called a midnight rock and roll show. And when the band started playing, that did it. I wanted to be a drummer. That was my first love. But my parents were like, oh, no.
Not in this house. Not under my roof.
It wasn't until I started to listen to country music that I heard that great guitar playing, which is what I listen to now when I want to hear some good guitar music, because nobody else is playing guitar but country. That's the only way you're going to hear them great licks, you know, today. So I've always been a country music fan, you know, because of the guitar playing. And that's when I switched over to guitar. And so I had a great... I had a chance to meet everybody that was anybody, Elvis, Michael Jackson. I got to meet all of them at one time or another, spent time around the Jacksons.
Any of them particularly memorable, the way you might want to give us a little something on them?
Well, Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, people like that.
You told us some good stuff. Tell that Stevie Wonder story.
Oh, well, Stevie was very animated. Like, he would just say things. One thing I noticed about Stevie, he could feel... colors. Like red, for some reason, has a hot feel. It's a warm feel. Like he'd go over to a woman and say, I love your red blouse.
My goodness.
And we'd be looking, you know. I'd be in the room with him alone and I'd do things like that. I try to poke, you know, and see if he could see. But yeah, he was very animated and his music was very hard. Very, very difficult.
I can believe that.
Yeah, some artists, like maybe I'd be with the Four Tops. And they would give me the show in music form. And I looked through the pages and said, oh, yeah, I can play that. Oh, yeah. Stevie, I had to be in my hotel room practicing.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm like, wow, I need another fan.
I have always thought his music. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Him and Ray Charles. Ray, when I auditioned for Ray Charles, you know, he can't see. So.
But before we go to Ray Charles, tell us that funny little skit about Stevie Wonder. You said one of the things he would go into a window
and pull the curtain back and say, oh, what a beautiful day, sunshiny, or what a rainy day.
Right.
Very perceptive. Had great, like after the show, he might come over and say, hey, Ken, that was a B-flat.
Got it.
I'm like, wow, you heard that?
and you've had too much to drink, I'm driving.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, Stevie stands out, Smokey Robinson. Ray Charles. I met Cher. She was a great person to work with. Some people have images that sometimes are bad, but everybody has a good image. Even Diana Ross, who they said was a diva, and she is. But I worked with her too.
Deservedly so, I might add.
And for a person who never wrote a song, she was very musical. She knew her music.
Mm.
And that's what I liked about her and people like Cher, because they weren't songwriters. They were just singers, but they knew their music. And when you played it wrong, they let you know. They let you know. Also coming out of Philly, people like Patti LaBelle I grew up with. I used to chase a Sister Sledge. You know, chase them all the time. I grew up with them.
Yeah.
Guys like the late Teddy Pendergrass.
Love him.
Grover Washington. These were all Philly people.
That's amazing. I didn't realize they were all Phillies.
And at the same time, I used to pal around with a guy named Clarence Clemens.
Why does that sound familiar?
He's the saxophone player for The Boss, Bruce Springsteen.
Ah, okay. I know I've seen that name.
And we would go over to Jersey and hang out with Bon Jovi, Bruce Springsteen. And this is before they were known. Guys like Hall & Oates.
Incredible.
Hall & Oates were a white group who sang Temptation songs, and they called themselves the Temptones. They were five white boys who did the steps and the singing, you know, like the Temptations. Oh, yeah, yeah. I was their band leader. This is before they were Hall & Oates, you know.
Wow.
So I had a chance to meet a lot of people before they were, you know, famous. There's a group out of Philly called the Stylistics.
I know the Stylistics.
The lead singer, he sat behind me in third, fourth, and fifth grade and sang in my ear every day, you know.
Stop that.
That's always been amazing to me, the people that did make it, because there was so much talent there in Philly.
That's amazing.
Then going on to Motown to play with people like that. So I have no complaints.
Ever have occasion to meet the Platters? They were big back in that day, too.
Yeah, I met the Platters. I met everybody at one time or another. You'd meet them in hotels. I was in a hotel one time, I forget what city, and I heard these horns playing in a room, coming from a room. Like, who is that? It was Chicago. They helped me stay at the same hotel. So you always got a chance to meet people. I met Elvis one time. I mean, it was nothing big. You know, it was a lot of people around and whatnot. Michael Jackson, I've probably met him or been around him four or five times. So you always got to meet people.
Yeah.
You know, it was always fascinating. Now, I used to have a scrapbook. I still have a few pictures, but I had a scrapbook because I take pictures with everybody that I could, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like doing that as well.
I started doing that during my chefing career when I was cooking for a lot of these folks, because nobody's going to believe you unless you got a picture.
Right. So I had a pretty amazing career. I was able not to get killed in a plane crash.
Ooh, tell us about that.
And stayed off of drugs.
Go back to the rewind, plane crash.
Well, he flew around a lot and never crashed.
Yeah. I always thought this how it was going to end.
I don't really want to make it that general, thank you very much.
Yeah, I always thought it would end that way.
Oh, you're just being, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Yes.
You avoided it, it didn't happen, good. I thought you were actually pointing at being in a plane that nearly crashed.
No. Okay. Well.
Who knows?
There were some moments. There were some moments.
Well, you're right, because a lot of the legends of the 60s did die in plane crashes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always thought that's how it's going to end. You know, I'll be with some superstar and, you know.
Time to hit the mountain.
Actually, the Otis Redding story, I went to England March of 67. He died in December of 67 in a plane crash. Had I been older, I probably would have stayed with him. But I had to go to school.
So gotcha.
That saved my life.
Yeah, yeah, no telling, yeah. Amazing. So
you mentioned a lot about the photography.
Well, okay, from music, I had my mother was a hairstylist for 40-some years.
Mm-hmm.
I ran from that. I had no interest in
hair. Didn't want to cut hair.
No. Because when I'd be mischievous, she'd make me come down to the beauty salon.
Oh, no.
But I hated that. I'm a musician.
I don't think parents realize, and forgive me for settling on that point for a minute, because there's a little story about my brother. I don't think parents realize that what they basically punish you with as a child becomes an aversion throughout life.
Yeah.
My brother was punished by being told to read. He won't read a book now as a result of it. You know, so it's be careful sad. What you do, folks.
That's sad.
So a childhood friend of mine in 77 is going to school to do hair. Well, in my neighborhood and in my journey, guys that did hair were gay. So I'm asking my friend, are you know.
I think the best ones still are.
Right.
Yeah.
He says, no. He said, I think it's going to be big business. I says, are you got that? Go ahead. So every time I'd come home off the road, He would say, you know, I made $1,000 this week. I'm like, doing what? He said, hair. He said, but the salon took 50%. I'm like, wow. So then he opened a salon, and he begged me to go in with him as a partner. No, I don't want nothing to do with hair. He says, well, I just need someone at the front desk to count the money that I can trust. So on occasion, I'd go by his salon, and he would say, yeah, Ken, if you come in, or we knock this wall down and put five more chairs in here, and we can make this, we can make that. I said, so what I got to do? He said, you got to run the front desk. Oh, no. Well, I tried it. And this leads me into photography. We did a photo shoot for a magazine, and when the photographer gave me the bill, I was like, wow, that's what you charge? The next day, I went out and bought a camera.
Very clever maneuver.
And that was 1983. I didn't have a clue. I just started, I'd take any girl out in the park and take pictures. So finally, people say, oh, I like that. I'll buy it. I'm like, really? You want to buy this? I must be pretty good. Mm-hmm. So photography led me into modeling. And I did that until I got burned out.
Led you into modeling photography.
Right.
Right.
Until I got burned out. And then I ran from Philadelphia and I ran down here.
Oh, my goodness.
And my plan was to do nothing, if you know what I mean. I said, maybe I'll get married and just settle down. Well, I had worked with Revlon and Clairol. And they would call me and say, Ken, what's going on in North Carolina? Nothing. They said, well, make something happen. I'm like, what do you want me to do? He said, do a hair show. Do something. I got back into the beauty business. Mm. And I had a radio show in Raleigh.
Where was it?
It was in Raleigh. It was on the AM station. And we talked about hair. Mm-hmm. So now I've gone from music to photography to hair. And now I'm in North Carolina. So I kept saying, wow, I'm always talking about something that's visual, but you can't see it on the air. So someone said, well, you know, in Chapel Hill, there's a place where you can go and produce your own TV shows. Like, really? Mm-hmm. I showed up.
Was this when cable or public cable access first came about?
I don't know if it first came about, but this was in 98.
That was around the time. It might have been more, like 90 when it started.
And so I showed up and I asked them, could I do a show, a producer show? They asked me if I could produce a show. Well, naturally, I said yes.
Been watching television all my life. I think right. I can do this.
Absolutely. So then I started with a show called Eyes. And as I looked around, you know, Chapel Hill being such a big melting pot with the university, mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of foreigners here. So we need a show to, you know, to address them. So then I came up with International Eyes. Then from
what
there,
is Eyes? What did that mean?
It just meant, it was just a name.
I mean, what did you do on the show?
Pretty much interview people.
Interview people. Okay.
Yeah, it was like
so
a magazine.
Like looking at people with eyes.
So
seeing.
Could be okay. Symbolic for perspectives.
Sort of.
Eye mm-hmm. on the yeah. world.
Eye on yeah. the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. When I did the skydiving show, it was called Eyes in the Sky.
Yeah, talk about that skydiving
show. I'd say there'd be big eyes in the sky.
Yeah. So from Eyes, I went to International Eyes, and I've always had international models. So my first host on my international show, she was Arab and American. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed the big Latino population growing and growing, mm-hmm. my neighbors, you know, in the community. So then I came up with Ojos Latinos, which is Latin eyes. So I'm always looking for something or some sort of niche. Skydiving we did on Eyes. I had a guy who wanted to do a show on skydiving. So we went out to Carolina Sky Sports in Lewisburg. Mm-hmm. And I went up in a plane and filmed other people jumping. And you'd be surprised, a lot of women of a skydiving. I'm like, wow, they got heart. But at the end, I only had like 15 minutes, and I needed an hour show.
Right.
So then the young guy that was hosting my show says, jump. Me? Jump?
Jump? Out of a perfectly good plane?
Right. So the instructor said, well, Ken, we have two parachutes.
Speaking of planes, we're picking one up on the microphone.
Trains.
Oh, that's what trains. Sorry. Planes, trains, and automobiles. Where was I?
And there's two parachutes, and one is computerized, in case you forget. So I thought, well, two parachutes, if neither one of them open, just wasn't my day. So I jumped. I jumped twice and filmed it.
But you said you had the camera on the helmet?
Yeah, I had a helmet that had a camera on the top and a remote.
Just a little segment here. A friend of mine lives in Lewisburg, close to the little airport where they do the diving. Yeah. And he was telling me about a fellow that they found like hours after a dive hanging dead in a tree. So
really?
some bizarre things can happen on those events.
It must have happened more recently because when
it
we
was.
Went, yeah, they hadn't had any accidents. At that point.
I guess I have to ask, what was that step like? What was that step out of the plane like?
I remember it like it was yesterday. It was in October. The leaves were changing. Uh-huh. It was a beautiful sunset, a type day. And it was the fact that the young guy had challenged me. Are you scared? Are you scared?
Yeah, right.
That first step.
Big ego couldn't handle that.
That first step is the heart.
It's got to be. I can just imagine being in that plane and, you know, the door being open and you looking down and there has to be all kinds of stuff holding you back from wanting to go out there.
And the most amazing thing is when you jump, they tell you where you're going to land. And I remember jumping and the first minute is free fall. You can turn around and do flips.
Mm-hmm.
And then your chute opens and you have about 8 minutes. And I saw that circle where I was supposed to land. I'm like, there's no way. There's no way I'm going to land on that circle. Came right down on it.
My goodness.
Right? I was very impressed. We went up 13,000 feet.
Oh.
Yeah. But it's beautiful. It's beautiful. The next
it's got to be beautiful, yeah. But it's got to take some sort of incredible control to actually step out of a plane.
No doubt.
Yeah. Like I said, with two parachutes, hey, neither one of them opens, it's just not your day.
I had a friend of mine that joined the military in Germany. Right after the apprenticeship, and he wrote me this, sent me this postcard saying how he had to do his first jump, and he said he peed his pants the entire way. So I can imagine it's woo.
Yeah. So TV was something I got like really into, and you know did some really great shows over the years. I've been doing it, which would be 12 years in January.
And it's just called KTV. What does that stand for?
Ken. I guess.
Ken, I would think, but what's the T?
Ken TV?
Ken Television. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And under KTV, I have the titles, Eyes and International Eyes.
I got you. All right.
Yeah.
And do you have a website to this effect that people can go to?
No, I sure don't. I haven't gone that far into it. Okay. It's so, you know, at one time I used to take my shows to Raleigh and to Durham and broadcast as well, but I stopped doing that because it gets to be involved.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So with TV, I used to always make tapes for my friends.
We have DVD copies of your shows.
Yeah.
Okay. So you could conceivably put them on a website eventually.
I could, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I sure could.
I would think so.
I've always made tapes for my friends. I had an imaginary radio station called WKLF, which is my initials. 106, which is my birthday.
Ah.
So I've been doing that for years. And then someone told me about WCOM. So it was just a natural progression to come over and do some radio.
Now, you've been here about 2 years?
No, I started in September of 09.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
September, yeah.
So it's just a little over a year then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A newcomer. Right. I would have, yeah. For some reason, I would have pegged you as somebody who's been here forever.
Well, it's only because I've been doing it forever.
Uh-huh.
Now, in Philly, when we had the beauty salons, I used to do specials on the beauty on the radio show whenever a singer was in town that I knew, mm-hmm. and I could get them to come on. So I kind of always done radio, you know. Like I said, here in the Carolinas, I did a show, but it was about beauty.
Mm-hmm.
So now I just love playing music. You know, 60s and 70s, rock, soul, and pop. I don't touch anything in the 90s. I may go into the 80s a little bit, but nothing of the 90s.
You play a lot of the people that you actually performed with?
I do that as well.
Did you wind up on any of the albums playing, or was that studio musicians?
That's studio musicians.
Usually is.
I played on Frankie Valli's album. I can't even remember the name of the album. The name of the song was Swearing to God.
Hmm.
So I played on that song. But I did more of the concert stuff.
Yeah.
Studio stuff was, you got a chance to stay home. The concert musician, you got a chance to travel
mm-hmm.
and go places and that sort of thing, which is a whole other part of music, you know, being that concert.
Because no doubt.
Things are done differently. the songs are played differently. And, you know, depending who the arranger is. But yeah, that was a great life, great life. It was what, and I tell young people, whatever it is that you want to do, do it. Because you don't want to get to be 60 and 70 and say, oh, I wish I had done that, wish I had done
I wonder
this.
What would have happened if, yeah.
Right. And even now when I go back to Philly, people say, wow, yeah, man, you know, you did that. sucks. Yeah, well, that's what I wanted to do. I knew at 9 years old that music was what I wanted to do. I just could feel it like that, you know. So, and then so many other people that I knew, they actually went and did it also.
And sadly, you don't play anywhere now.
No, I don't have the drive.
I imagine you still pick up the guitar and play for yourself.
Yeah, because it's good exercise.
Yeah.
But I only play my stuff. I don't sing, but I play my songs that I've written. I don't know. I think it comes a point where you've lived your dream, so you have to move on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like I'm sitting at home going, gee, I wish I could play for Stevie now. I've already done
that. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So you just kind of move on.
You've kind of got nothing to prove to yourself anymore in that regard.
Right. My father always told me, you can't make a living as a musician. And if you're really, really that good, you'll play with Ray Charles.
Well, you did that.
So you did.
Yes.
Yes,
so
indeed.
There.
There you go, Pops.
Yeah. You know, I had nothing else to prove.
Yeah.
And then you were never, ever going to go to hair, and you ended up with beauty salons. So. Very interesting.
Who would have ever thought?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, my mother never, I never did hair. I just ran the front desk.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And that was enough, because that was a 14, 15-hour day dealing with women.
Mm-hmm.
We would do...
And he's shaking his head, folks. He's shaking his head like, ugh.
We would do 120, 130 heads on Friday.
Wow.
And I had to interact with each one of those clients. They got to be...
You heard some stories, I'm sure.
And seen some things as well. But I learned a lot about the hair industry. We were... our salon was on the cutting edge of hair in the 80s in Philly as a black salon. We did a lot of things first. We, as they say, we came onto the market like gangbusters, you know, because things were changing in the black community hair-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And it needed, the shop that my mother had was not the type of shop that we had. We did, we had a contract with the... if any superstar came into Philly to perform, we did their hair.
Ah, all right.
We did the TV anchor lady's hair. We did the radio announcer's hair. We did the the mayor's wife. We did her hair.
Interesting. How did you manage to get that so focused on you?
Well, we focused on those type of people.
All right.
We had an upscale salon. Let's
say. You basically had a reputation that helped that along.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Whenever... somebody important needed their hair done, they always came to us.
Gotcha.
My partner, who actually did hair, we set it up that way, that we were going to be the biggest and the best black salon in Philly. We were the first black salon to even open a salon in Center City, Philadelphia.
Hmm. Well, that's probably why you got so much of the higher echelons, because you were the first... to be doing it.
I can see that.
In a classy way, too.
Right. It's the same way with music. You know, I sat around and dreamed about playing for Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, not Joe's band.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, who wouldn't in that field, yeah.
Right. You know, I mean, after playing with Otis, I mean, I set my sights, you know, real high.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know who Stanley Clarke is.
Oh, of course I do. I've actually stage managed him at the Carolina Theater.
Well, I went to high school with him.
Amazing.
Yeah. And when I met Stanley told me, the first day I met him, he says, I don't play no rock and roll. I says, well, all I play is jazz, too. So we got along well. So once you know, have been up here, you don't want to come back.
I fully understand that. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
You know, once you play Madison Square Garden, you know, a bar is just...
I would say so, yeah, no.
It's just not the same.
You can't.
But you set your sights high. And if you... But you got to be qualified now.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be qualified,
no doubt.
You know, and coming up in Philly, as I said, the competition was just fierce. You know, in every corner there was somebody trying to play better than you, sing better than you, or be better than you. So, as they say, competition breeds winners.
I would say the challenge. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you ever made a CD or would think of making a CD of your own music.
I have what. Okay, yes. I have a couple of songs that I have on CD.
Uh-huh.
And then I have what I call work tracks.
Uh-huh.
because I don't sing, I always have to wait for that singer to come by to put the vocal on my song.
Right, right.
So I have the instrumental tracks already and waiting for a singer,
uh-huh.
that sort of thing.
I want to hear some of this.
No smoking.
So do I.
I smoked cigarettes, and I was looking for a way to quit. So I wrote a song, and all I had was lyrics.
Is that the one you just sold?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And 20 years later, I'm watching TV, and they say North Carolina has received, I think it was $7.5 million to fund anti-smoking commercials. I'm like, wow, I got a song. So I went and got my song, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, who would be interested in this? American Cancer Society. I called them, and every year they have what they call the Great American Smokeout.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they try to get people to quit for a day.
Right.
So I sent them the lyrics, and they called me. They said, oh, we like this. Is this a song? I says, yeah, it's a song. It's a song. She says, well, I'm going to send it to our people in Atlanta and see if they like it. And she did, and they called me. They said, this is really good. They said, well, maybe your group, since you have this song in a group, and I didn't, can go around to IBM and SAS and companies like that on the Great American Smokeout and sing the song. So I said, you really like it? They said, yeah, the lyrics are really, really great. I said, well, this is a national thing you do, right? They said, yeah. I said, well, how about we perform the song on Good Morning America? They said, wow, that would really be good. I said, you like that? They said, yeah. I said, well, while we're in New York.
Captain of the ship here, yes, let's do this.
This guy's good.
Yes.
I said, well, you know, if you like that, I'm in New York. We can do a David Letterman show. The lady says, oh, this is really getting good. I says, well, if you like that, on our way to New York, because we're coming from North Carolina.
I hope this is going somewhere.
I says, we can stop in D.C. and sing it with the president on the East Lawn.
Hey, there we go.
He says, oh, yeah, this is getting really, really good, Ken, really, really good. I said, well, and maybe Oprah, too.
Yeah.
They said, send me the song. All I had was lyrics.
Uh-huh.
What, no music?
No music.
Okay.
I wrote music. I put an ad in the paper. I went around to high schools. I interviewed 94 teenagers. Because I wanted the song to be directed at teens.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of them could sing. They could rap, but they couldn't sing. So it never happened. 2 years later, I finally got a singer, recorded the song, and went back to the American Cancer Society. They loved it.
All right.
So they wanted to buy the song. I said, no, I'm not selling the rights. So what we did was we came up with a deal for X amount of dollars where they could use the song in commercials around the country. And then it would revert back to me. So that's what I do now. It's all about me in a sense now. Because I did everything, you know, for other singers.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah. So I have another song called No Drinking and Driving. So
that's great, Ken. That really is great.
Just want to remind everybody, you're listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. We're getting close to wrapping up the hour. This is WCOM 103.5 FM. And I'm here in the studio with my wonderful co-host, Audrey Layden, and Ken Fuller, whom we are interviewing. He's a concert musician, photographer, TV producer, and radio show host. His television show is KTV, and his radio show is Rock, Soul, and Pop, 60s and 70s. And he's on WCOM every Friday from 11 to 1 p.m. And here he is again, Ken.
So that's pretty much my background. That's
so
pretty
impressive, bro.
What's next?
What's next?
I think Kilimanjaro.
When are you going to write a book? And you can come on Carver Book Beat.
Yes, there we go. That's Audrey's show.
I'd like to take Claudio to the next level.
All right.
I think,
brother, you're talking something I'd like to hear there.
Yeah, I think he's got some great things that need to be exposed, you know, to the community as well as the world. And sometimes it takes two or three people, you know, from different backgrounds to come together in the perfect mix.
I fully agree.
And make it happen. That's always been my experience. You can't never do everything on your own. You're always going to need, you know, it's like I tell people all the time, like I can write the song, play the song, I just can't sing the song. I don't want to be on TV, but I'll put you on TV. You know, put me behind the scenes, let me produce. You know, that sort of thing. So I'm very much a behind the scenes kind of person. As opposed to being out front. I use a different name on my radio show. I use the name Kimani Fuller.
And Kimani Fuller. Okay.
Yeah. It's Fuller, F-U-L-A. That's a tribe.
Fuller.
In Kenya.
All right. And your wife is from Kenya.
Right. And Kimani is an African name, which means one who comes in peace. So I use that on the radio because it gives me a different persona from Ken Fuller, KTV.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
And besides, on the radio, all you hear is my voice. You don't see me. So, once again, behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I'm more of the creative force.
And I'm a little of both. I love the creative aspect. And I really, if I can find somebody that I feel can do my work justice, I have no problem playing in the background. But the problem I've had with a lot of the work I've written, especially for theatrical productions, is that nobody could give it the dynamics that I could give it.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that I don't care as much about performing it, I've sort of been pushed forward by the audiences to do it because nobody could give it the, as they call, Burton-esque aspect.
Well, Claudio, you have just got this fantastic, beautiful voice.
Thank you.
Your speaking voice is just incredible.
Because I started out in South Africa in boarding school just telling stories. We didn't have television, didn't even know what TV was. I came here in 69, television scared the hell out of me.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know what it was. I'll tell the story very quickly. We just did a 24-hour flight from Johannesburg, South Africa, actually not, to Jan Smuts Airport, to here, international flight, landed in New York City, and I remember when those doors first opened, we had to change planes and naturalize. And I remember those doors. I'd never dealt with humidity. In Africa, the heat is dry. If you sit in a shady spot, it's cool. And I remember those doors being open, and I saw 13 other airplanes lined up right next to us. And I looked at the stewardess, and I said, man, those airplanes sure put off a lot of heat. And it was just mid-July in America. And she looked at me and says, oh, you poor kid.
Yeah.
And we ended up going to this motel room just before going to, actually, it was in Winston-Salem. So we were coming from South Africa to Winston-Salem. My dad was taking a vice president job with a tool and die company. And went into the motel room, saw this bubble box sitting on a cabinet. My brother went outside for a swim. I turned this thing on, thinking it was just some kind of a stereo music box. And I went in to wash my face in the bathroom, and I'd come from Africa as a street fighter. So I was used to being in some kind of a brawl. Well, all of a sudden, I hear this arguing going on in the bedroom. And I come out of the bathroom with both my fists ready, and I'm ready to tell somebody to get out of my room because I figured, you know, what are you arguing in my room for? And I looked, and it's Some Like It Hot on television with Tony Curtis and who is the other one going at each other in the movie Some Like It Hot, Marilyn Monroe, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. Yeah.
Yeah.
And fast forward 30 years later, I worked Some Like It Hot, the Broadway version, in which Tony Curtis now played a secondary role. And after building the set and all that, we'd been playing pranks on each other, the techies. I feel this pat on my back, and I figure it's one of the techies getting ready to pull a fast one on me, so I turn around with both my fists clenched, and there's Tony Curtis going, no, 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 just wanted to let you know, love what you guys have done, great job. So I wanted to tell him, boy, I could tell you a story about a 30-year span of me and my fists when you came in the picture.
Yes,
but
exactly.
I never did tell him.
Every time you see Tony Curtis, he's ready to punch.
That's
interesting.
But anyway, and what drew me more and more into my own literature was people would ask me over the years in South Africa when I'd run into these same kids that I told stories to later, the first question coming out of their mouths would be, are you still telling stories? And that sort of slipped me into it more and more. I loved creating them. I never really planned on doing more than telling stories to, you know, casually to friends. And then that just sort of pushed me. I was literally thrown on stage.
That's where you belong.
Thanks.
That's where you belong.
But no, when I connected with you and I realized that, I mean, WCOM really has a wealth of talent here on its own. I have people like Audrey, who's supporting literature like I do, and then running into you on a day that I came to scare people, Halloween.
And we had some ghost stories.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
There was some of the greatest things that happened that day were some of the stories we told before the show.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how all that works.
But Chapel Hill is a place that, you know, like I said, it embraces art.
Yes.
It embraces,
I do love it for that.
Talent.
Chapel Hill and Carborough. We've got to throw Carborough in there.
I lived in Burlington. Oh, God, it was like dead. It was like something out of the 50s. really.
You're not talking about Vermont. You're talking about
North Carolina.
North Carolina, okay. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Lord, no.
So I had to come back to
Chapel
Hill.
That's a very industrial area, isn't it, Burlington? Or formerly industrial.
Formerly. It's an old mill town.
Yeah.
That has died pretty much. No art. no talent, a little beauty, but not a lot. And then the beauty, you know, a beauty has to have art.
Absolutely.
You know, in order for it to grow.
It's got to have expression. That's right. Art.
Yeah.
Exactly.
They didn't have any of that there. And I suffered. I bought a house there. That was a big mistake.
Mm.
So I ran back to Chapel
Hill. Were you able to sell it?
Oh, yeah. I got out. No public transportation.
How long did you live there?
6 years.
Goodness. You held out for a while.
Yeah.
Ken, I've got to remonstrate you or urge you that when you say Chapel Hill, say Carborough Chapel Hill.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, I'm noticing that.
We're actually in Carborough.
We're in Carborough.
I step away from the hill.
I speak as a Carboroughite. Chapel Hill is great, but
I lived in Carborough first on Highway 54.
Then he got run over by bicycles and he left.
And I never understood why it was Carborough and Chapel Hill. I mean,
it all feels like one big place, doesn't it? Yeah,
pretty much. Yeah.
Well, you know, we're always, 7 degrees cooler than Chapel Hill?
Oh, is that it? Okay. So we're on the cool side, bro.
And, you know, when I first started doing my TV show, it didn't broadcast in Carborough.
Right.
That just happened, yeah. So.
Oh, there's something I wanted to convey to anyone interested out there in the listening world about the Carolina Theater. Recently, they had Mike Birbiglia on there, the comedian, and this is just sort of one of the more touching things that's happened to me recently. And my voice is the, so to speak, God voice of the Carolina Theater on all pre-recorded announcements for the house. And every so often, a comedian that comes on the stage decides to poke fun at the voice, the recording that came on before he entered the stage. One time it happened during the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, and most recently with Mike Birbiglia. And apparently he went into a little 2-3 minute comedy skit about poking fun at my voice, like, who is this guy? Did they have to fly somebody in from England? Nobody around here talks like that, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the evening, as they were loading him out, the crew told him, by the way, Claudio works with us. He's one of us. Just want to let you know, we didn't have to fly him in from England. So he went to my wall, because my picture and my autograph is also on the Carolina Theater wall, because I performed with the North Carolina Symphony there on several occasions. And wrote right next to my picture, I dedicate my show to Claudio, Mike Birbiglia.
Really?
So thanks, Mike.
That's very nice. You have to hold on. Don't let them ever get rid of that photograph.
Yeah, right.
And the Carolina Theater, you say, is haunted.
Oh, many times over, yes.
Okay, we have to come and do a show on that because, you know, the Carolina.
Well, let's just say it's got some spirits there that quite a few of us have become familiar with. Okay. As far as being haunted, I don't know that it necessarily scares any of the public. It's sort of something you become more intimate with being
when
working
there. All by yourself at 2 o'clock in the morning.
And I've spent many a night there by myself. Yeah, yeah. No, there's a
that's
and
a
that's not, they're not threatening presences. Not at least not to me. I have known some people that literally got booed away.
That'd make a great TV show. We have to cover that.
It's a great. Well, think about it. The place was built in the 20s, 27, somewhere around there. And it's seen, started out with Top Hats and Tails, like Eddie Arnold, and, you know, seen that the 20s, the Prohibition, the whole thing. As a matter of fact, there's a whole wall on top of the theater that's sectioned off because it's where the blacks used to have to sit to watch the performances. Now it's a storage space. So there's an amazing amount of history to it. And it's just a beautiful building. It pretty much, it's very ambient with its history there.
So if anybody out there that's listening interested in being a TV host, they should contact us.
Uh-huh.
And how did they do that?
Well, you can call the station, 929-9601. And Claudia is on every day. I mean, not every day, but every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday.
Yeah.
Tuesday from 10 to 11, yes.
Yeah. And I'm on from 11 to 1 every Friday. Just contact us.
And you're talking about, you're actually looking for somebody that may be able to help you hosting your television show.
Right, KTV.
You like being more behind the camera.
Exactly.
And I are definitely going to do some work together.
Is there an email for people that people could email anybody?
It's KTV_talent @yahoo.com.
Okay.
And mine is, you can go to my website, www.claudioarts.com. Slipped up on my own information there, and we're getting ready to wrap this up here. Any kind of contact information beyond what you've just conveyed that you'd like to add to today's show?
No. Ken? It was a pleasure being here.
Absolutely. And I think it's going to be the first of many times of having you on.
As I said, from here we got to go to TV.
That sounds good to me.
We have to bring it into the visual
and
stage.
And I'm very interested in collaborating with you on some efforts.
Looking forward to
pretty
it.
Soon.
Looking forward to it.
Well, Audrey, once again, I think we might as well bow out so that John Paul, if he shows up, or when he shows up, can just sort of take the helm.
Okay.
Anything you want to add about your show before we go off the air?
Oh, yeah, thanks. This week, you might. Monday at 10 o'clock, Carborough Book Beat is going to be talking about and giving away books. We get we get lots of books from people.
So does that mean the public should come here to get the books?
Well, what it means is that we'll be asking people to email us at producers@att.com or call in and give us names and contact. We will not be mailing things, but we will set up a date, maybe like Saturday morning,
when they can come and get them.
Pick them
perfect.
Up.
What about you, Ken? Want to mention about your show coming up?
Well, I won't be on the air this Friday.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But every Friday from 11 to 1, I play the best rock, soul, and pop, 60s and 70s.
And that's when it was the best, man.
Yep.
Well, on that note, I'm going to take us out with a little meditation from, what's the comedian's name? Oh, I can't think of his name. Who gave us this political speak? I just cannot think of his name right now. Anyway, the gist of it is, remember that politicians are like diapers and must be changed often. For the same reason.
George Carlin?
No, well, it comes close. Not George Carlin, but I can't think of his name now. I'm growing old. I've had a mind freeze. It's that really funny guy that winds up in a lot of movies.
Okay.
But I can't think of his name now. So anyway.
Okay.
Just watch your politicians out there, folks, because they usually don't do the job we expect them to do. And on that note, this is the Speakeasy signing off. Until next time, cheers.